already back in 1975, is that the climate, the unusual, or as they called it, abnormal stable climate which we've had over the last 100 years, is not the norm, and therefore we should not expect that that will stay. So we're likely going to see more unstable climates. So how do we, maintain our quality of life, meet our needs, and particularly, my primary interest is in food and agriculture. You know, how do we continue to provide an adequate amount of food under those new circumstances? I think those are some of the new challenges that we need to be addressing.
I'd like to go back to a point you made earlier, and I want to know why it is that you think the land grants are avoiding the science of the impact of technology in favor of the science of the technology itself.
Yeah. That's a really good question, and I think part of it is because of the predominant narrative. What do I mean by narrative? It's we all operate out of a vision, out of a way that we think about life in general, and our institutions are no different from that. Scott Peters published an essay a couple of years ago in which he pointed out there are actually two narratives now which dominate the thinking in our land-grant universities. And one is what he calls the heroic narrative. You know, we're the institution that created the technologies which are, you know, increasing the yields of our crops and producing all of these great things. And, you know, and of course, when you operate out of that kind of narrative, then you don't really see much need for change or, you know, you just keep doing more of what you've been doing. And then he says there's a second narrative, and that's the what he calls the tragic narrative. And those are the people who are saying, yeah, you know, you invented all these technologies. That's precisely the problem. You know, that's what's causing climate change. That's what's causing us to pollute our water and causing hypoxia zones in the Gulf of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. And again, if you operate out of that tragic narrative, you're also not likely to see much change because you're saying, you know, the dominant narrative is so much in control, there's nothing we can do about it. And so Scott argues that one of the things we should be doing in our land-grant universities now is to think about what our new narrative should be. How should we be thinking about ourselves if we're going to face these new challenges that we're confronted with? And so I think part of the reason that we haven't looked at the unintended consequences of our technologies is because, you know, we're caught up in this heroic narrative, and so we don't see the need to do it.
Hmm. Is it part and parcel of chasing dollars?
Well, yeah, I mean, that certainly also plays a role. You know, our land-grant universities are still predominantly funded by public funds. It varies from state to state. In Iowa, if I recall, I think we're a little over 70% of our funding comes from public dollars. But then you have funding come in from the outside, from the private sector, that provides research for particular kinds of research. And, of course, you do want to pay attention to that funding, and you don't want to see it disappear. And so it is, it would be abnormal to not pay some attention, you know, to that and to, to hone your message that's favorable to, the people that are giving you additional funding.
So let's go back to where you were headed with the heroic and the tragic narratives and suggesting that we need to change the narrative altogether. What do you have for suggestions?
Well, you know, Scott Peters says that the new narrative should be centered on what he calls sustainability and freedom. In other words, how do we solve these problems? How do we address these challenges that we're facing? How do we keep things? How do we keep going? How do we keep, how do we maintain a quality of life? And we have to have more engagement of the general public in this. That's where the freedom part comes in. That there's much more openness and involvement of average citizens in helping us to think through, how we're going to. So, in other words, so that we're doing this together and not, I think a big mistake that we often make is that we look to particular institutions, and some of us look to our land grant universities to kind of be the lone ranger and come in and save us. That generally doesn't work because then there's no engagement and ownership in it, and people haven't felt involved. And so I think we need to have much more community engagement. And in my reading, at least, that was part of the original vision of the land grant. That's why it was called the People's University. You know, there are some countries that are doing this now. In Denmark, for example, they now have science shops so that, you know, scientists actually are out in the community in various locations, and people from the community can come and say, you know, I'm facing this kind of problem. Can you help me with some research, you know, that can solve this problem? I'm not saying that's the answer to everything, but it's one way to approach that engagement, which I think we need.
You're talking about something different than what came along later than the land grants, the extension service. You're talking about something different than that?
Yeah, this was in,
but is that what you're suggesting, though, something that would be in addition to or different than the engagement or the outreach programs that are operated by land grant systems?
Well, I think, extension? You know, I think it can, you know, I think, for example, I think that the extension service now, which, of course, came along a little bit later with the Smith-Lieber Act,
right.
I think extension now is more important than it's ever been in its history. Because many of the problems that we're facing now are not going to be solved with technology. They're going to be solved by people working together, thinking together, by creating new way, finding new ways to manage farming systems. For example, as energy costs continue to go up, you know, at least as I've looked at what are the alternatives here. Well, one of the alternatives, and there's some farmers all over the world now that are on a very small scale are starting to do this, and that is instead of farming specialized monocultures, which always require a lot of energy input, they're now developing highly biological synergies. In other words, they have some animals in the system, they have some plants in the system, and everything that's in the system, every species that's in the system, contributes energy as well as taking energy. So you have Joel Salatin in Virginia, for example, who has a rotational grazing system, and he now has, I think, 7 species of animals that go through that system. He puts the beef cattle into the paddock first. They're in there for 24 hours. Then he moves them onto the next paddock. 90 hours later, he brings in the chickens. Why the chickens in 90 hours? Well, in 90 hours is when the grubs and the larvae and the cow pies have developed, so they're perfect feed for chickens. So the chickens feed on that, and in the process of feeding on that, they scratch the cow pies around it, spreads the manure for more fertilizer, for more grass. So I think, you know, some of those, how do we begin to manage systems that produce their own energy in that way rather than being dependent on energy from outside? Extension is in a perfect role, you know, to work with farmers to try to think through some of those kinds of systems. So they aren't just technology transfer individuals anymore. They become active people engaged in trying to work with farmers and with others to develop these new approaches.
We need to take a break here in just about 2 minutes, so be prepared for that. And then we'll ask if you want to join that conversation with Fred Kirschman this afternoon, you can. The numbers are 333-9455, that's 217 locally, or 800-222-9455. We'll take a break in a couple of minutes. So tell me more about this, because I'm wondering, is it possible to have folks like Joel work into the bigger system? Because it seems to me that the bigger industrial system just demands more of the same from him in greater quantities. Can he manage to pull off the smaller system that has a greater number of species and continue to work through the kind of food processing system already in place?
Well, that's actually the research question, I think, that we need to be addressing. You know, can some of these kinds of systems be scaled up? You know, I think they can, but we won't know until we can actually do the research and create the models and see whether or not they work. The other thing is that, and there are a number of people now who are, you know, we have focused our current industrial agriculture system's efficiency entirely on labor efficiency. It's not energy efficient. It's very labor efficient. And we have prided ourselves and felt that that was the only efficiency that we really needed to, accomplish. So we now at a point as of the 2002 statistics where we only have a little over 400,000 farmers who are producing 94% of our food. So it's enormously labor efficient.
Fred, we'll take that labor efficiency up in 2 minutes, okay? Thanks much. Brad Kirschman is with the Leopold Center, where he's a former director. We're talking about sustainability and the land grant system here on the Closing Market Report.
WILL programming is made possible by Tires Plus Total Car Care, located at Prospect and Market View in Champaign. Tires Plus provides complete car repair and maintenance. More information is available at 366-3201.
Let's take a quick look at the forecast for the two-state region from our own chief meteorologist, Ed Keezer. Here's what the extended forecast highlights look like. Ed says dry weather will continue during the weekend and on into Monday of next week. The next chance of showers doesn't come until Monday night or Tuesday, and the model trend shows a slowing of the approach of that front, and that those showers next week might even hold off until late on Tuesday in many areas. Warmer than average temperature readings are expected through early next week. That'll favor, of course, harvesting conditions across Illinois and Indiana. Slightly cooler weather expected during the middle of next week, but that'll quickly be followed by the return of some seasonably warm weather. Ed says the latest American GFS model puts sub-freezing temperatures into much of North Dakota, northwestern Minnesota on Monday morning, and then takes that cold northeastward, missing most of the Midwestern Corn Belt. The models are now holding off an additional cold air through October the 22nd. Beyond that, accuracy, of course, is a little low on those models, according to our own Ed Keezer. Here's what the forecast for the two-state region looks like tonight. Clear, says Ed, lows will range from 39 in northeastern Indiana to 52 in the south, and the mid-50s along Chicago's lakefront. Tomorrow, sunny, highs will range from 68 in far northeastern Illinois to 83 in the far south.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Compañía Flamenco José Porcel on October 10th. This energetic dance troupe will be followed with a free afterglow performance in the lobby from Eastern Bloc. More information is at krannertcenter.com.
Just about 7 more minutes to continue our conversation this afternoon here on the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report with Fred Kirschman. He's former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State. We're talking about the land grant system and sustainable agriculture across the United States and around the globe. Just a bit when we left, our discussion was centering around labor efficiency in the United States and how the focus has been on labor efficiency as opposed to energy use. Would you like to continue on with that conversation, Fred?
Yeah, sure. So I think that energy, one of the things we'll find is that energy costs go up. There will be a point at which labor will have a comparative advantage to energy, and then how will that change agriculture? Well, there are several people that have tried to begin to anticipate that, and Richard Heinberg, who's with the New College in California, for example, he's now predicting that by the year 2030, 2040, we could have as many as 40 to 50 million people that will be engaged in producing our food in one way or another, you know, growing more of their own food and gardens, community gardens. He sees an increase in horticulture, agriculture versus grain agriculture, grain and animal agriculture. You know, I'm not saying he's got all of that right, but we do have, you know, we have people who are trying to envision, you know, how this impact of, you know, one of the ways of thinking about this is suppose that oil was $300 a barrel, and, you know, T-Boone Pickens is now telling us it'll be $350 in the next 10 years, so it's not an unreasonable, you know, target to peg it on. So let's suppose that oil was $300 a barrel, that we could only use half the amount of water that we're currently using, and that we have twice the severe weather events. You know, what kind of agriculture would we put on the landscape so that it would continue to be productive? Well, I think it would be a much more diverse agriculture than we have now. It would obviously be one that requires a lot less energy, probably would require more labor, but that would be an exchange that probably would be acceptable to us. So we really have to start thinking in those terms, I think, and not continue to stay locked into the current narrative, which is totally based on maximum production and short-term return, because what we're going to need is resilient production and long-term return. And so that's one of the shifts I think we have to make in our thinking.
So a couple of decades ago, there was something called LISA, Low Impact Sustainable Agriculture.
Right.
Would that be something you can see coming back?
Well, it actually is with us still, because LISA got transformed into SARE, the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, which is still operating. And I think the SARE program has done some research which is going to be helpful to us. But we still got a long way to go. We got a lot of new models that we have to test out. I think our future agriculture is going to be much more adapted to local situations. So we're not going to have one seed variety that's used all over the world. We're going to have seed that's locally adapted to local cultures and local climates. We're going to have more animal crop mixtures that are adapted to local place with breeds that are adapted to local place. And I think those, from some of the early evidence we've seen, these mixed agriculture systems, because you're going to be producing more than one commodity off the same acreage, can be enormously productive and resilient.
Are there places around the nation that are more likely to do this than others? For instance, here in the Prairie State, it would seem unlikely that that could happen.
Yeah, we're already seeing this. You know, right now these new approaches are happening more on the coast than they are in the in the central part of the country. But we're seeing some of it in the central part of the country too. You know, there's a farmer in near Elbia, Iowa, for example, who's experimenting with raising grapes and sweet corn and poultry all together in the same system. So the poultry provides the fertility by virtue of the poultry droppings. The poultry eat the insects and the weed seedlings as they come up, so he doesn't have to cultivate the corn after it's about 4 inches tall. You know, and according to, and again, the SARE program did a research project to determine, to do the numbers on that, and they concluded that he was doing about $10,000 an acre net profit. Now, I don't know a lot of, you know, monoculture farmers that are, you know, creating that kind of profit. Now, it's a much more complex system. You know, a lot of people don't like that kind of complexity. The thing that I'm finding, though, now is that young people all across the country want to start farming now, and they're interested, and they're not, you know, they grew up on the internet. They're not afraid of complexity. In fact, they welcome it. So I think we're going to see a lot of changes that we should again, you know, encourage and have some conversations about, and really look at a lot of different alternatives and not get locked into one way of doing things, because I think that would not prepare us for the future.
And you think that the land grant system will should be responsible for looking at that?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, if it truly is the people's university as it was originally envisioned, then it needs to listen to the people, and it needs to make more opportunities for different approaches rather than, you know, putting, I mean, right now we're putting about 90% of our research dollars into new technologies. Well, what about if we put, say, 30 or 40% of our research dollars into restoring the health of our soil, because that's a critical piece. You know, all the research has been done on this. We know that healthy soil, healthy biologically active soil, only uses about half the amount of water. So that begins to prepare you for, you know, more drought periods. So this, you know, there's just a lot of things that we could